This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Untamed. This is the author, Glennon Doyle. For every woman resurrecting herself. For the girls who will never be buried. Mostly for Tish. Prologue. Cheetah. 2 summers ago, my wife and I took our daughters to the zoo. As we walked the grounds, we saw a sign advertising the park's big event, the Cheetah Run. We headed towards the families scouting out their viewing spots and found an empty stretch along the route. Our youngest, Emma, hopped up on my wife's shoulders for a better view. A peppy blonde zookeeper in a khaki vest appeared. She held a megaphone and the leash of a yellow Labrador retriever. I was confused. I don't know much about animals, but if she tried to convince my kids that this dog was a cheetah, I was getting a Cheetah Run refund. She began, "Welcome, everybody. You are about to meet our resident cheetah, Tabitha. Do you think this is Tabitha?" "No," the kids yelled. "This sweet Labrador is Minnie, Tabitha's best friend. We introduced them when Tabitha was a baby cheetah, and we raised Minnie alongside Tabitha to help tame her. Whatever Minnie does, Tabitha wants to do." The zookeeper motioned toward a parked Jeep behind her. A pink stuffed bunny was tied to the tailgate with a fraying rope. She asked, "Who has a Labrador at home?" Little hands shot into the air. "Whose lab loves to play chase?" "Mine," the kids shouted. "Well, Minnie loves to chase this bunny. So first, Minnie will do the cheetah run while Tabitha watches to remember how it's done. Then we'll count down, I'll open Tabitha's cage, and she'll take off. At the end of the route, just 100 meters that way, there will be a delicious steak waiting for Tabitha." The zookeeper uncovered Tabitha's cage and walked Minnie, eager and panting, to the starting line. She signaled to the Jeep and it took off. She released Minnie's leash and we all watched a yellow lab joyfully chase a dirty pink bunny. The kids applauded earnestly. The adults wiped sweat from their foreheads. Finally, it was time for Tabitha's big moment. We counted down in unison, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The zookeeper slid open the cage door, and the bunny took off once again. Tabitha bolted out, laser-focused on the bunny, a spotted blur. She crossed the finish line within seconds. The zookeeper whistled and threw her a steak. Tabitha pinned it to the ground with her oven mitt paws, hunkered down in the dirt, and chewed while the crowd clapped. I didn't clap. I felt queasy. The taming of Tabitha felt familiar. I watched Tabitha gnawing that steak in the zoo dirt and thought, day after day, this wild animal chases dirty pink bunnies down the well-worn, narrow path they cleared for her. Never looking left or right, never catching that damn bunny, settling instead for a store-bought steak and the distracted approval of sweaty strangers. Obeying the zookeeper's every command, just like Minnie, the lab she's been trained to believe she is. Unaware that if she remembered her wildness just for a moment, she could tear those zookeepers to shreds. When Tabitha finished her steak, the zookeeper opened a gate that led to a small fenced field. Tabitha walked through and the gate closed behind her. The zookeeper picked up her megaphone again and asked for questions. A young girl, maybe 9 years old, raised her hand and asked, "Isn't Tabitha sad? Doesn't she miss the wild?" "I'm sorry, I can't hear you," the zookeeper said. "Can you ask that again?" The child's mother said, louder, "She wants to know if Tabitha misses the wild." The zookeeper smiled and said, "No, Tabitha was born here. She doesn't know any different. She's never even seen the wild. This is a good life for Tabitha. She's much safer here than she would be out in the wild. While the zookeeper began sharing facts about cheetahs born into captivity, my older daughter, Tish, nudged me and pointed to Tabitha. There, in that field, away from Minnie and the zookeepers, Tabitha's posture had changed. Her head was high, and she was stalking the periphery, tracing the boundaries the fence created. Back and forth, back and forth, stopping only to stare somewhere beyond the fence. It was like she was remembering something. She looked regal and a little scary. Tish whispered to me, "Mommy, she turned wild again." I nodded at Tish and kept my eyes on Tabitha as she stalked. I wished I could ask her, "What's happening inside you right now?" I knew what she'd tell me. She'd say, "Something's off about my life. I feel restless and frustrated. I have this hunch that everything was supposed to be more beautiful than this." I imagine fenceless, wide-open savannas. I want to run and hunt and kill. I want to sleep under an ink-black, silent sky filled with stars. It's all so real, I can taste it. Then she'd look back at the cage, the only home she's ever known. She'd look at the smiling zookeepers, the bored spectators, and the panting, bouncing, begging best friend, the lab. She'd sigh and say, "I should be grateful. I have a good enough life here. It's crazy to long for what doesn't even exist." I'd say, "Tabitha, you are not crazy. You are a goddamn cheetah." Part 1. Caged. Sparks. 4 years ago, married to the father of my 3 children, I fell in love with a woman. Much later, I watched that woman drive away from my home to meet with my parents and share her plan to propose to me. She thought I didn't know what was happening that Sunday morning, but I knew. When I heard her car return, I settled into the couch, opened a book, and tried to slow my pulse. She walked through the door and directly toward me, bent down, kissed my forehead. She pushed my hair aside and took a deep breath of my neck, like she always does. Then she stood up and disappeared into the bedroom. I walked to the kitchen to pour some coffee for her, and when I turned around, she was right there in front of me, down on one knee, holding a ring. Her eyes were certain and pleading, wide and laser-focused, sky blue, bottomless. "I couldn't wait," she said. "I just could not wait another minute." Later in bed, I laid my head on her chest while we talked about her morning. She'd told my parents, "I love your daughter and grandchildren like I've never loved before. I've spent my entire life searching and preparing myself for them. I promise you that I will love and protect them forever." My mother's lip quivered with fear and courage as she said, "Abby, I have not seen my daughter this alive since she was 10 years old." Much else was said that morning, but that first response from my mother jumped out at me like a sentence in a novel begging to be underlined. "I have not seen my daughter this alive since she was 10 years old." My mother watched the spark in my eyes fade during my 10th year on Earth. Now, 30 years later, she was witnessing the return of that spark. In the past few months, my entire posture had changed. I looked regal to her and a little scary. After that day, I began to ask myself, where did my spark go at 10? How had I lost myself? I've done my research and learned this. 10 is when we learn how to be good girls and real boys. 10 is when children begin to hide who they are in order to become what the world expects them to be. Right around 10 is when we begin to internalize our formal taming. 10 is when the world sat me down, told me to be quiet, and pointed toward my cages. These are the feelings you may express. This is the version of womanhood you will mimic. This is the body you must strive for. These are the things you will believe. These are the people you may love. Those are the people you will fear. This is the kind of life you will want. Make yourself fit. You'll be uncomfortable at first, but don't worry. Eventually, you'll forget you're caged. Soon, this will just feel like life. I wanted to be a good girl, so I tried to control myself. I chose a personality, a body, a faith, and a sexuality so tiny I had to hold my breath to fit myself inside. Then I promptly became very sick. When I became a good girl, I also became a bulimic. None of us can hold our breath all the time. Bulimia was where I exhaled. It was where I refused to comply, indulged my hunger, and expressed my fury. I became animalistic during my daily binges. Then I'd drape myself over the toilet and purge, because a good girl must stay very small to fit inside her cages. She must leave no outward evidence of her hunger. Good girls aren't hungry, furious, or wild. All of the things that make a woman human are a good girl's dirty secret. Back then, I suspected that my bulimia meant that I was crazy. In high school, I did a stint in a mental hospital, and my suspicion was confirmed. I understand myself differently now. I was just a caged girl made for wide open skies. I wasn't crazy. I was a goddamn cheetah. When I saw Abby, I remembered my wild. I wanted her, and it was the first time I wanted something beyond what I had been trained to want. I loved her, and it was the first time I loved someone beyond those I had been expected to love. Creating a life with her was the first original idea I'd ever had, and the first decision I made as a free woman. After 30 years of contorting myself to fit inside someone else's idea of love, I finally had a love that fit, custom made for me, by me. I'd finally asked myself what I wanted instead of what the world wanted from me. I felt alive. I'd tasted freedom, and I wanted more. I looked hard at my faith, my friendships, my work, my sexuality, my entire life, and asked, how much of this was my idea? Do I truly want any of this, or is this what I was conditioned to want? Which of my beliefs are of my own creation, and which were programmed into me? How much of who I've become is inherent? And how much was just inherited? How much of the way I look and speak and behave is just how other people have trained me to look and speak and behave? How many of the things I've spent my life chasing are just dirty pink bunnies? Who was I before I became who the world told me to be? Over time, I walked away from my cages. I slowly built a new marriage, a new faith, a new worldview, a new purpose, a new family, and a new identity by design instead of default. From my imagination instead of my indoctrination. From my wild instead of from my training. What follows are stories about how I got caged and how I got free. Apples. I am 10 years old, and I'm sitting in a small room in the back of Nativity Catholic Church with 20 other kids. I am at CCD, where my parents send me on Wednesday nights to learn about God. Our CCD teacher is my classmate's mom. I do not remember her name, but I do remember that she keeps telling us that she is an accountant during the day. Her family needed service hours, so she volunteered to work in the gift shop. Instead, the church assigned her to room 423, fifth grade CCD. So now, on Wednesdays between 6:30 and 7:30 p.m., she teaches children about God. She asks us to sit on the carpet in front of her chair because she is going to explain to us how God made people. I hurry to get a spot in front. I am very curious about how and why I was made. I notice that our teacher does not have a Bible or any other books in her lap. She is going to speak from memory. I am impressed. She begins. God made Adam and put him in a beautiful garden. Adam was God's favorite creation, so he told Adam that his only jobs were to be happy, rule over the garden, and name the animals. Adam's life was almost perfect, except that he got lonely and stressed. He wanted some company and help naming the animals. So he told God that he wanted a companion and a helper. One night, God helped Adam give birth to Eve. From inside Adam's body, a woman was born. That is why she is called woman, because women came from the womb of man. Womb man. I am so amazed that I forget to raise my hand. Wait, Adam gave birth to Eve? But don't people come from women's bodies? Shouldn't boys be called woman? Shouldn't all people be called woman? My teacher says, raise your hand, Glennon. I raise my hand. She motions for me to put it back down. The boy sitting to my left rolls his eyes at me. Our teacher goes on. Adam and Eve were happy, and everything stayed perfect for a while. But then God said there was one tree they couldn't eat from, the tree of knowledge. Even though it was the only thing that Eve wasn't allowed to want, she wanted an apple from that tree anyway. So one day, she got hungry, picked the apple off the tree, and took a bite. Then she tricked Adam into taking a bite too. As soon as Adam bit into the apple, Eve and Adam felt shame for the first time and tried to hide from God. But God sees everything, so God knew. God banished Adam and Eve from the garden. Then he cursed them and their future children, and for the first time, suffering existed on the earth. This is why we still suffer today, because Eve's original sin is inside of all of us. That sin is wanting to know more than we are supposed to know, wanting more instead of being grateful for what we have, and doing what we want to do instead of what we should do. That was some careful accounting. I had no further questions. Blowjobs. My husband and I began working with a therapist after he admitted that he had been sleeping with other women. Now we save up our problems throughout the week and take them to her on Tuesday evenings. When friends ask me if she's any good, I say, I guess so. I mean, we're still married. Today, I've asked to see her alone. I'm tired and jittery because I spent all night silently rehearsing how to tell her what I'm about to tell her. I sit quietly in my chair, hands folded in my lap. She sits upright in the chair across from me. She wears a crisp white pantsuit, sensible heels, no makeup. A wooden bookshelf crowded with textbooks and framed degrees climbs the wall behind her like a beanstalk. Her pen is poised above a leather notebook in her lap, ready to pin me down in black and white. I remind myself, speak calmly and confidently, Glennon, like a grown-up. I have something important to tell you. I've fallen in love. I am wildly in love. Her name is Abby. My therapist's mouth falls open, just enough for me to notice it. She says nothing for an eternal moment. Then she breathes very deeply and says, "Okay." She pauses, starts again. "Glennon, you know that whatever this is, it's not real. These feelings are not real. Whatever future you're imagining here, that's not real either. This is nothing but a dangerous distraction. It won't end well. It has to stop." I start to say, "You don't understand. This is different." But then I think about all the people who have sat in this chair and insisted, "This is different." If she won't let me have Abby, I need to make my case at least for never again having my husband. "I cannot sleep with him again," I say. "You know how hard I've tried. Sometimes I think I've forgiven, but then he climbs on top of me and I hate him again. It's been years and I don't want to be difficult, so I close my eyes and try to float away until it's over. But then I accidentally land back inside my body and what I land in is white-hot, fiery rage. It's like I try to go dead inside, but there's always a little life left in me, and that life makes sex unbearable. I can't be alive during sex, but I can't get dead enough either, so there's no solution. I don't want to do it anymore." I am furious that tears come, but they do. I am begging now. Mercy, please. Two women, one white suit, 6 framed degrees, 1 open notebook, 1 pen poised. Then, "Glennon, have you tried just giving him blowjobs instead? Many women find blowjobs to be less intimate." Directions. I have a son and 2 daughters, until they tell me otherwise. My children believe that the shower is a magical portal of ideas. My youngest recently said to me, "Mom, it's like I don't have any ideas all day, but when I get in the shower, my brain is full of cool stuff. I think it's the water or something." "Could be the water," I said. "Or it could be that the shower's the only place you're not plugged in, so you can hear your own thoughts in there." She looked at me and said, "Huh?" "That thing that happens to you in the shower, babe, it's called thinking. It's something folks did before Google. Thinking is like, it's like Googling your own brain." "Oh," she said, "cool." That same child steals my expensive shampoo once a week, so the other day I stomped to the bathroom she shares with her teenage brother and sister to steal it back. I open the shower curtain and notice the 12 empty bottles littering the tub's edge. All the bottles on the right side were red, white, and blue. All the bottles on the left side were pink and purple. I picked up a red bottle from what was clearly my son's side. It was tall, rectangular, bulky. It yelled at me in bold red, white, and blue letters, 3 times bigger. Doesn't rob you of your dignity. Armor up in man scent. Drop kick dirt, then slam odor with a folding chair." I thought, what the hell? Is my son taking a shower or preparing for war in here? I picked up one of the girls' slim, metallic pink bottles. Instead of barking marching orders at me, that bottle, in cursive, flowy font, whispered disconnected adjectives. Alluring, radiant, gentle, pure, illuminating, enticing, touchable, light, creamy. Not a verb to be found. Nothing to do here. Just a list of things to be. I looked around for a moment to ensure that the shower was not, in fact, a magic portal that had somehow transported me back in time. Nope. There I was, in the 21st century, when boys are still being taught that real men are big, bold, violent, invulnerable, disgusted by femininity, and responsible for conquering women and the world. when girls are still being taught that real women must be quiet, pretty, small, passive, and desirable, so they'll be worthy of being conquered. Here we all are. Our sons and daughters are still being shamed out of their full humanity before they even get dressed in the morning. Our children are too vast to fit themselves inside these rigid, mass-produced bottles. But they'll lose themselves trying. Polar bears. Several years ago, my daughter Tish's teacher called and said that there was a situation at school. During a discussion about wildlife, she'd mentioned to the class that polar bears were losing their homes and food sources because of the melting ice caps. She showed the students a photo of a dying polar bear as an example of the many effects of global warming. The rest of the kindergartners thought that this was sad information, but not sad enough to keep them from, you know, soldiering on to recess. Not Tish. The teacher reported to me that when the lesson ended and the other kids popped off the carpet to run outside, Tish remained seated, alone, mouth wide open, stunned into paralysis, her little shocked face asking, "What? Did you just say the polar bears are dying because the earth is melting? The same earth that we live on? Did you just drop that little tidbit of terror on us at circle time?" Tish eventually made it outside, but was unable to participate in recess that day. The other kids tried to get her off the bench to play foursquare with them, but she remained close to her teacher, wide-eyed, asking, "Do the grown-ups know about this? What are they going to do? Are other animals in trouble too? Where is that hungry polar bear's mom?" For the next month, our family's life revolved around polar bears. We bought polar bear posters and papered Tish's wall with them. "To remember, Mom, I've got to remember." We sponsored 4 polar bears online. We talked about polar bears at dinner, at breakfast, during carpool, and at parties. We discussed polar bears so incessantly, in fact, that after a few weeks, I began to hate polar bears with every fiber of my being. I began to rue the day that polar bears were ever born. I tried everything I could think of to yank Tish out of her polar bear abyss. I coddled her, I snapped at her, and finally, I just lied to her. I asked a friend to send me an official email pretending to be the president of Antarctica, announcing that, once and for all, the ice caps were fixed and all the polar bears were suddenly A-okay. I opened that fraudulent email and called to Tish in her room. "Oh my gosh, baby, come here. Look what I just got. Good news." Tish read the email silently, then turned slowly toward me with a scathing look of scorn. She knew the email was fake because she is sensitive, not stupid. The polar bear saga continued, full force. One night I tucked Tish into bed and was tiptoeing out of her room with the joy of a mother who was almost to the promised land. Everybody's asleep and I've got my couch and carbs and Netflix and no one is allowed to touch me or talk to me until the sun rises, hallelujah. I was closing the door behind me when Tish whispered, "Wait, Mom?" "Damn it to hell." "What, honey?" "It's the polar bears." "Oh, hell no." I walked back to her bed and stared down at her, a little maniacally. Tish looked up at me and said, "Mommy, I just can't stop thinking. It's the polar bears now, but nobody cares. So next, it's gonna be us." Then she rolled over, fell asleep, and left me all alone in the dark room, stunned into paralysis myself. I stood over her, eyes wide, arms wrapped around my body. "Oh my God, the polar bears! We have to save the mother freaking polar bears!" Next, it's gonna be us. What is wrong with us? Then I looked down at my baby and thought, ah, you are not crazy to be heartbroken over the polar bears. The rest of us are crazy not to be. Tish couldn't go to recess because she was paying attention to what her teacher said. As soon as she heard the polar bear news, she let herself feel the horror and know the wrongness and imagine the inevitable outcome. Tish is sensitive, and that is her superpower. The opposite of sensitive is not brave. It's not brave to refuse to pay attention, to refuse to notice, to refuse to feel and know and imagine. The opposite of sensitive is insensitive, and that's no badge of honor. Tish senses. Even as the world tries to speed by her, she is slowly taking it in. Wait, stop. That thing you said about the polar bears, it made me feel something and wonder something. Can we stay there for a moment? I have feelings. I have questions. I'm not ready to run outside to recess yet. In most cultures, folks like Tish are identified early, set apart as shamans, medicine people, poets, and clergy. They are considered eccentric, but critical to the survival of the group because they are able to hear things others don't hear, and see things others don't see, and feel things others don't feel. The culture depends on the sensitivity of a few, because nothing can be healed if it's not sensed first. But our society is so hell-bent on expansion, power, and efficiency at all costs that folks like Tish, like me, are inconvenient. We slow the world down. We're on the bow of the Titanic, pointing, crying out, "Iceberg! Iceberg!" while everyone else is below deck, yelling back, "We just want to keep dancing." It is easier to call us broken and dismiss us than to consider that we are responding appropriately to a broken world. My little girl is not broken. She is a prophet. I want to be wise enough to stop with her, ask her what she feels, and listen to what she knows. Tick marks. It's my senior year of high school, and I still haven't been nominated to homecoming court. Homecoming court is made up of the 10 most popular students in each grade. Those 10 will dress up and ride in convertibles in the homecoming parade, dress up and walk the field at halftime, dress up and walk the halls wearing their homecoming court sashes. Homecoming is high school fashion week, and the rest of us will watch the members of the court walk the runways from our places in the shadows. Our teachers pass out ballots in English class and instruct us to vote for the students who should ascend to court. Each year, we vote in mass for the same 10 golden ones. We all know who they are. It feels like we were born knowing who they are. The golden ones stand together in a closed circle, like the sun, in the hallways, at football games, at the mall, and in our minds. We are not supposed to look directly at them, which is difficult because they have shiny hair and their bodies are alluring, light, and radiant. None of them is a bully. Bullying would require paying far too much attention and exerting far too much effort. They are above and beyond that. Their job is to ignore the rest of us, and our job is to judge ourselves against the standards they set. Our existence makes them golden, and their existence makes us miserable. Yet we vote for them year after year because the rules control us even at the privacy of our own desks. Vote for the golden ones. They have followed directions perfectly. They are what we are all supposed to be, so they should win. Fair is fair. I am not golden, but the golden one's light reflects on me just often enough that I am tinged. They invite me to their parties occasionally, and I go, but when I get there, they don't talk to me much. I assume I'm there because they need some ungold around in order to feel their goldenness. Goldenness requires contrast. So when they stand in circles at football games, they let me join their circle, but they don't talk to me there either. I feel terribly uncomfortable, left out and ridiculous in those circles. I remind myself that what is really happening in the circle doesn't matter. What matters is what people outside the circle perceive to be happening there. What matters is not what is real, but what I can convince others is real. What matters is not how I feel inside, but how I appear to feel on the outside. How I appear to feel will determine how others feel about me. What matters is how others feel about me. So I act like someone who feels golden. By mid-September, the buzz of homecoming preparations has reached fever pitch. We've just cast our ballots, and the winners will be announced in 6 period. I'm in student government class, and our job is to count the votes. My friend Lisa is pulling ballots out of a box, one at a time, and reading the names aloud while I tally the votes. She calls out the same names again and again. Tina, Kelly, Jessa, Tina, Kelly, Jessa, Susan, Jessa, Susan, Tina, 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 and then Glennon. A couple more. Glennon. Glennon. Lisa looks at me, raises her eyebrows, and smiles. I roll my eyes and look away, but my heart pounds in my chest. Holy shit, they think I'm golden. I can see that the ballot box is almost empty, but the votes are close and I could make it. I could make it. I need just 2 more votes. I look over at Lisa, and her eyes are diverted. With my pencil, I make 2 more marks next to my name. Tick, tick. Lisa and I count the votes. I have been nominated for homecoming court. I am now a girl who, even when she's 44 years old, can roll her eyes and mention, offhandedly, "Oh, well, I was on homecoming court." Others will roll their eyes too. High school. But they will also register. Ah, you were golden. Golden is decided early. And it sticks somehow. Even when we are grown and know so much better, so much more. Once golden, always golden. For more than a decade, I have written and spoken openly about addiction, sex, infidelity, and depression. Shamelessness is my spiritual practice. Yet I have never admitted to committing high school voter fraud to anyone but my wife. When I told her that I'd finally written this story, she winced and asked, "Are you sure, babe? Are you sure you should tell that one?" I think what makes this story unforgivable is the desperation. It's the wanting, the caring so much. If one cannot be golden, then one must pretend that one does not want to be. It's so uncool, so terribly uncool, to want to belong so badly that you're willing to cheat for it. But I did. I rigged an election trying to be golden. I spent 16 years with my head in a toilet trying to be light. I drank myself numb for a decade, trying to be pleasant. I've giggled at and slept with assholes, trying to be touchable. I've held my tongue so hard I tasted blood, trying to be gentle. I've spent thousands on potions and poisons, trying to be youthful. I have denied myself for decades, trying to be pure. Algorithms. Several months after I found out my husband had repeatedly been unfaithful, I still didn't know whether I'd stay or go. I didn't even know if the new throw pillow on my couch would stay or go. I was a terribly indecisive woman. When I told the counselor at my kid's school how uncertain I felt, she said, "It's not hard decisions that mess up kids, it's indecision. Your kids need to know which way this is going to go." I said, "Well, they can't know until I know." She said, "You need to figure out how to know." Back then, the only way I knew how to know was to poll and research. I began polling. I called each of my friends, hoping that they would know what I should do. Next, I began my research. I read every article I could find about infidelity, divorce, and children, hoping the experts would know what I should do. My polling and research results were maddeningly inconclusive. Finally, I turned to the World Wide Web to see if an invisible conglomeration of strangers, trolls, and bots knew what I should do with my one wild and precious life. That is how I found myself in bed at 3 a.m., shoveling Ben and Jerry's into my mouth, typing into my Google search bar, "What should I do if my husband is a cheater, but also an amazing dad?" Gatherings. My 17-year-old son, Chase, and his friends are in the family room watching a movie. I've been trying to leave them alone, but it's hard for me. I understand that most teenagers think their moms are uncool, but I'm certain I'm the exception. I stand at the door and peek inside. The boys are draped all over the couch. The girls have arranged themselves in tiny, tidy, roly-poly piles on the floor. My young daughters are perched at the feet of the older girls, quietly worshiping. My son looks over at me and half smiles. "Hi, Mom." I need an excuse to be there, so I ask, "Anybody hungry?" What comes next seems to unfold in slow motion. Every single boy keeps his eyes on the TV and says, "Yes." The girls are silent at first. Then each girl diverts her eyes from the television screen and scans the faces of the other girls. Each looks to a friend's face to discover if she herself is hungry. Some kind of telepathy is happening among them. They are polling. They are researching. They are gathering consensus, permission, or denial. Somehow, the collective silently appoints a French-braided, freckle-nosed spokesgirl. She looks away from the faces of her friends and over at me. She smiles politely and says, "We're fine, thank you." The boys looked inside themselves. The girls looked outside themselves. We forgot how to know when we learned how to please. This is why we live hungry. Rules. My friend Ashley took her first hot yoga class recently. She walked into the room, unrolled her mat, sat down, and waited for something to happen. "It was exceptionally hot in there," she told me. When the instructor, young and confident, finally walked into the room, Ashley was already dripping with sweat. The instructor announced, "We'll start soon. You're going to get very hot, but you can't leave this room. No matter how you begin to feel, stay strong. Don't leave. This is the work." The class got started, and a few minutes in, the walls began to close in on Ashley. She felt lightheaded and sick. Each breath became harder and harder to come by. Twice her vision became spotty, then briefly went black. She looked at the door and felt desperate to run toward it. She spent 90 minutes terrified, close to hyperventilating, holding back tears. But she did not leave that room. The moment the instructor ended the class and opened the door, Ashley jumped off her mat and ran into the hallway. She kept her hand over her mouth until she found the bathroom. She threw the door open and vomited all over the sink, the wall, the floor. While she was on her hands and knees, wiping up her own puke with paper towels, she thought, "What is wrong with me? Why did I stay and suffer? The door wasn't even locked." Dragons. When I was a little girl, my godmother gave me a snow globe as a birthday gift. It was small and round, like a palm-sized crystal ball. In its center stood a red dragon with sparkly scales, bright green eyes, and fiery wings. When I first took it home, I put it on the nightstand beside my bed. Then I'd lie awake at night, wide-eyed, feeling afraid that the dragon existed so close to me in the dark. So one night I climbed out of bed and moved the snow globe to the highest shelf in my room. Every once in a while, only in the light of day, I'd pull my desk chair over, climb up, and pull the snow globe off the shelf. I'd shake it, get still, and watch the snowflakes swirl. As they began to settle, the fiery red dragon in the center of the globe would emerge, and I'd feel a chilly thrill. That dragon was magical and scary, always there, unmoving, just waiting. My friend Megan is 5 years sober now, after a decade of alcohol and drug abuse. Lately, she's been trying to figure out what happened to her, how addiction had taken over the life of such a strong woman. On Megan's wedding day, she sat in the back of the chapel knowing she didn't want to marry the man waiting for her at the end of the aisle. She knew it from her roots. She married him anyway because she was 35 years old, and getting married was what she was supposed to do. She married him anyway because there were so many people she would have disappointed if she had called it off. There was only one of her, so she disappointed herself instead. She said, "I do," while her insides said, "I don't." And then she spent the next decade trying not to know what she knew, that she had betrayed herself and that her life would not really begin until she stopped betraying herself. The only way not to know was to get wasted and stay that way. So she started drinking heavily during her honeymoon. The drunker she became, the more distance she felt from the dragon inside her. After a while, the booze and drugs became her problem, which was convenient because she didn't have to deal with her real problem anymore. We're like snow globes. We spend all of our time, energy, words, and money creating a flurry, trying not to know, making sure that the snow doesn't settle, so we never have to face the fiery truth inside us, solid and unmoving. The relationship is over. The wine is winning. The pills aren't for back pain anymore. He's never coming back. That book won't write itself. The move is the only way. Quitting this job will save my life. It is abuse. You never grieved him. It's been 6 months since we made love. Spending a lifetime hating her is no life at all. We keep ourselves shaken up because there are dragons in our center. One night, back when my children were babies, I was reading a book of poetry in the bathtub. I came across a poem called A Secret Life, about deep secrets and how we all have them. I thought, well, I haven't had one since I got sober. I don't keep secrets anymore. That felt good. But then I read, it becomes what you'd most protect if the government said, you can protect one thing, all else is ours. It's what radiates and what can hurt if you get too close to it. I stopped reading and thought, oh, wait. There's one thing I haven't even told my sister. My secret that radiates is that I find women infinitely more compelling and attractive than men. My secret is my suspicion that I was made to make love to a woman and cuddle with a woman and rely on a woman and live and die with a woman. Then I thought, so odd. That cannot be real. You've got a husband and 3 children. Your life is more than good enough. As I climbed out of the tub and shook my hair dry, I told myself, maybe in a different life. Isn't that interesting? As if I had more than one. Arms. I sit in a cold plastic seat near the airport gate, stare at my suitcase, sip airport coffee. It's bitter and weak. I look at the plane through the gate window. How many of those will I board in the coming year? 100? I'm bitter and weak, too. If I board, this plane will take me to Chicago O'Hare, where I'll search for a driver holding a sign with my husband's last name on it. I'll raise my hand and watch the driver's face register surprise that I am a small woman in sweatpants instead of a large man in a suit. The driver will deliver me to the Palmer Hotel, where a national book conference is being held. There, I'll stand on a stage in a grand ballroom and speak to a few hundred librarians, about my soon-to-be-released memoir, Love Warrior. Love Warrior, the story of the dramatic destruction and painstaking reconstruction of my family, is expected to be one of the biggest books of the year. I will be promoting it on stages and in the media for, well, forever. I'm trying to find my feelings about this. Fear? Excitement? Shame? I can't isolate anything specific. I stare at the plane, wondering how to explain my life's most intimate, complicated experience to a sea of strangers within my 7 allotted minutes. I have written a book, and now I must become a commercial for the book I have written. What is the point of being a writer if I have to say words about the words I've already written? Do painters have to draw about their paintings? I'd been at this airport gate starting line before. 3 years before, I'd released my first book and traveled the country telling the story of how I'd finally found happily ever after by trading my lifelong food and booze addictions for a son, a husband, and writing. I'd stood on stages all over the country and repeated the book's message to hopeful women. Carry on. Life is hard, but you are a warrior. One day it will all come together for you, too. Right after that first book's ink dried, I sat in a therapist's office and listened to my husband say that he'd been sleeping around since our wedding. I held my breath as he said, "There have been other women." And when I inhaled again, the air was made of smelling salts. He kept apologizing while looking down at his hands, and the impotent stammering made me laugh out loud. My laughter made both men, my husband and his therapist, visibly uncomfortable. Their discomfort made me feel powerful. I looked at the door and willed adrenaline to carry me out of that building, across the parking lot, and into my minivan. I sat in the driver's seat for a while and realized that the revelation of my husband's betrayal did not leave me feeling the despair of a wife with a broken heart. I was feeling the rage of a writer with a broken plot. Hell hath no fury like a memoirist whose husband just fucked up her story. I was furious with him and disgusted with myself. I'd let down my guard and trusted that the other characters in my story would act as they should and that my plot would unfold as I'd mapped it. I'd rendered my own future and my children vulnerable by ceding creative control to another character. What an idiot. Never again. I would take back full control starting now. This was my story and my family, and I would decide how it ended. I'd take this shit I'd been handed, and I'd spin it into gold. I took control back with words, sentences, chapters, and scripts. I started with the story's resolution in mind, a healed, whole family, and worked backward from there. There would be rage, pain, therapy, self-discovery, forgiveness, reluctant trust, and then, eventually, fresh intimacy and redemption. I do not know if I lived the next few years and then wrote about what happened, or if I wrote the next few years and then made it all happen. It didn't matter. What mattered was that at the end of that blur of time, I had myself a dark love story, a drama of betrayal and forgiveness, pain and redemption, brokenness and healing, in book form and family form. Checkmate, life. In Ann Patchett's Truth and Beauty, a reader approaches Lucy at her book signing table and asks of her memoir, "How do you remember all of that?" "I don't remember it," she says. "I write it." When Love Warrior was complete, I handed the manuscript to Craig and said, "Here, here is what it all meant. I made it all mean something. We won the war. Our family made it. We are a love story after all. You are welcome." Now the war's ended, and I want to go home. But home is still a foxhole with me and Craig left staring at each other, wondering, what now? What did we win? I call my sister and ask if I can cancel the book launch event in Chicago. I want her to tell me that this will be fine, no big deal. She says, "We can cancel, but it will be a big deal. You committed to this." So I do this thing I do. From the outside, I imagine it looks like a straightening, a stiffening. From the inside, it feels like turning my liquid self to a solid, water to ice. Glennon has left the building. I've got this. I board the plane to go tell a story I'm not sure I believe. It will be okay. I'll just tell it like a story instead of a life, as if I am past the end instead of stuck in the middle. I'll tell the truth, but I'll tell it with a slant. I'll blame myself just enough, present him in the most sympathetic light, attach my bulimia to my frigidity and my frigidity to his infidelity. I'll tell how the cheating led to my self-reflection, how self-reflection led to forgiveness and pain led to redemption. I'll tell it so that people will decide, of course, it was leading to this ending all along. I see. It all had to happen exactly that way. That is what I will decide too. The moral arc of our life bends toward meaning, especially if we bend it that way with all our damn might. I arrive in Chicago and meet my book publicist at the Palmer House Hotel, where the event is being held. This weekend is the literary Super Bowl, and she's buzzing. We are on our way to a dinner where 10 authors will get to know one another before we head into the ballroom and pitch our upcoming books from the stage. This dinner, which I have just learned about a few hours before, has heightened my introvert terror alert level from yellow to red. The room where the authors are to have dinner is small, with two long conference tables pushed together to form a square. Instead of sitting, people are milling. Milling with people I do not know is my idea of hell on earth. I do not mill. I walk over to the drink table and pour in ice water. A famous writer walks over and introduces herself. She asks, "Are you Glennon? I've been wanting to talk to you. You're the Christian one, right?" "Yes, I'm the one." "My new book is about a woman who has a religious experience and becomes a Christian. Do you believe it? A Christian. It feels so real to her. I don't know how my readers will react. Will people be able to take her seriously? What do you think? Do you feel like people take you seriously?" I say the most serious thing I can think of and then excuse myself. I look at the table. No assigned seats, damn it. George Saunders sits quietly at the end of the table. He seems gentle and kind, and I'd like to sit next to him, but he is a man, and I don't know how to talk to men. At the end of the table is a young woman with calm energy. I sit down next to her. She is a 20-something releasing her first children's book. I ask her question after question while considering how wonderful it would be if the organizers would just place our books on the table so we could get to know each other by reading silently. We butter our rolls. Salads are served. As I'm reaching for dressing, the children's book lady looks over at the door. I look over too. Suddenly, a woman is standing where nothingness used to be. She takes up the entire doorway, the entire room, the entire universe. She has short hair, platinum on top, shaved on the sides. She's wearing a long trench coat, a red scarf, a warm half smile, cool steel confidence. She stands still there for a moment, taking inventory of the room. I stare at her and take inventory of my entire life. My whole being says, "There she is." Then I lose control of my body. I stand up and open my arms wide. She looks over, cocks her head to the side, raises her eyebrows, smiles at me. "Fuck, fuck, fuck, why am I standing? Why are my arms open? Oh my God, what am I doing?" I sit back down. She walks around the table and shakes everyone's hands. When she gets to me, I stand up again, turn around, face her. "I'm Abby," she says. I ask if I can hug her because what if this is my only chance? She smiles and opens her arms. Then, the smell that will become home to me, skin like powder and fabric softener blended with the wool of her coat and her cologne and something that smelled like air, like outdoors, like crisp sky, like a baby and a woman and a man and the whole world. The only seat left is at the far end of the table, so she walks away from me and sits down. She'll later tell me that she didn't eat or speak because all of her energy was spent trying not to stare. Mine too. Dinner ends and there is more milling. Oh my God, more milling, and now with a revolution in the room? I excuse myself to go to the bathroom and kill 2 milling minutes. When I walk out, she is standing in the hallway, watching the bathroom door, waiting. She motions to me to come over. I look behind me to make sure it's me she's talking to. She laughs. She laughs. Then it's time to walk to the ballroom. We separate ourselves from the pack somehow. There are people 3 feet in front of us and behind us, but here we are, walking alone together. I want so badly to be interesting. But she is so cool, and I don't know how to be cool. I've not been cool a day in my life. I am warm, burning up, sweating through my shirt already. She starts talking, thank God. She tells me about the book she's about to release. She says, "But things are hard right now. You've probably heard." Heard what? I have not heard. What would I have heard, and where would I have heard it? She says, "The news, maybe? ESPN? No. I have not heard the news on ESPN, I say. She speaks, slowly at first, then all at once. I'm a soccer player, was a soccer player. I just retired, and I'm not sure what I am now. I got a DUI last month. It was all over the news. I watched my mugshot scroll across the ticker for days. I can't believe I did it. I've been really lost and depressed the last couple of years, and I screwed up. I've always been about honor, and I ruined my whole legacy. I let everybody down. I hurt the whole team, maybe. And now they want me to write my book as some kind of hero, athlete, puff piece. But I keep thinking, what if I'm just honest? What if I write the truth about my life? I am sad for her, but I am thrilled for me. In our 4 minutes together, she has asked me about the 3 subjects I know best: drinking, writing, and shame. This is my jam. I've got this. Hot damn. I put my hand on her arm. Electrical currents. I pull back and recover enough to say, "Listen, I have a rap sheet as long as your arm. I'd write it all. I'd be honest. I don't know much about the sports world, but I do know that out here in the real world, we like real people." She stops walking, so I do too. She turns and looks directly at me. It appears that she's about to say something. I hold my breath. Then she turns and keeps walking. I start breathing and walking too. We enter the ballroom and follow the other authors through a sea of round tables, white tablecloths, 30-foot ceilings, crystal chandeliers. We end up at the dais,